Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And we begin today with the case of the lying homicide detectives. New York State's highest court yesterday threw out two murder convictions on the grounds that police simply lied too much to the suspects to get them to confess. The court ruled that police may lie to suspects during interrogations, but only a certain amount. What an interesting piece of law. Where is that line? Let's ask Stephen Drizin from the Center on Wrongful Convictions at the Northwestern University Law School in Chicago. Professor Drizin, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Well, good morning from Chicago.
Two cases here. Number one, Adrian Thomas of Troy, upstate near Albany, with a dead baby on his hands, his own four-month-old son. Police tell Thomas he must explain how he injured the infant to save the baby's life. But in reality, the baby was already brain dead. And police told Thomas he was not responsible for the injuries and would not be prosecuted in the death. More lies intended to evoke a confession, which they got. Thomas demonstrated on videotape how he slammed the baby down on three occasions in the week before the child died. Thomas was then, of course, charged, and he was convicted of murder on the basis of his confession. The court said the interrogator's lies were too big and threw out Adrian Thomas's conviction. Is this a groundbreaking decision?
It is. It's a watershed decision, and really one of the first times that a high court and the New York High Court has pushed back on a period of extreme deference to law enforcement in the use of tactics during interrogations.
Some of our listeners may know of the Adrian Thomas case from the film Scenes of a Crime or a recent New Yorker article called The Interview. Case number two, a New Rochelle woman is dead of a heroin overdose, but police tell the suspect, Paul Avini, her boyfriend, that she's alive. They demand to know what drugs he gave her in order to prevent an adverse reaction with medications intended to save her life. Avini had previously denied injecting her with anything, but under the pressure of being told the information could save her life, which was a lie, he confesses, and he gets convicted of criminally negligent homicide. So the court yesterday threw out that conviction, too. Is this ruling a break with past law in any way?
It is. This particular tactic of lying to a suspect about the well-being of loved ones in order to get them to confess was used in the case of another man named Marty Tankliff when police officers told him that his father had awoken from a coma and fingered him for committing his attempted murder and his wife's murder. And that was upheld by the court. So these kinds of tactics where you lie to a suspect about the condition or well-being of their loved ones have been blessed before by the high court. And I think in the future that if police officers use them, they are going to lose these confessions.
You mentioned the Tankliff case and then these two cases that the rulings were about yesterday, one in Troy, one in New Rochelle, are unrelated, but they're similar in just that way you were defining, that both times the police lied about a dead victim being alive and asked for information from the suspects that would save their victims' lives. So is this a common interrogation technique?
It's common. It's not as common as the other techniques which the court took issue with in the case, but I have seen it in other interrogations around the country.
What other technique were you referring to that the court took issue with in the case?
The biggest technique that was at issue in this case was the use of what's called the accident scenario, telling a suspect that they know that this crime was not intentional, that it was just an accident, and both implying or directly suggesting that the suspect would not be prosecuted or would be able to go home or would not be arrested if he just confessed to an accidental killing. That tactic is used every single day in police stations in every jurisdiction in this country, and this court took issue with it here in the Thomas case.
This is a fundamental human paradox, right? Lying in pursuit of the truth, a paradox. but that doesn't necessarily mean it's morally wrong. Police would later acknowledge that they lied to produce the true confession. And I haven't seen anything in the articles on this, maybe you know more, that suggests that either man was innocent, that Adrian Thomas didn't kill his baby by abusing him multiple times, or that Paul Levine didn't inject heroin into his girlfriend who OD'd. So what's the principle here as far as you're concerned as a professor and as an advocate? What's the greater good?
Well, let me just say one thing. There is a lot of evidence to suggest that Adrian Thomas is absolutely innocent of this crime. The medical evidence in this case from the best doctors in the country showed that this child was dying from a raging sepsis infection and not a head injury, and that the diagnosis that there was a skull fracture on this baby, which led the police down this path, was wrong. But in both cases, in both the Avini case and in the Thomas case, what is stunning is that the final confessions of both of these men were essentially scripted by law enforcement officers. Every single fact in these confessions was suggested first by the law enforcement officers to the suspect, and then the broken down suspect simply regurgitated these facts, and the police tried to pass his confession off as if it was the suspect's confession when it was really their own confession. And what the court in Thomas was able to do for the first time in New York is see this all play out on videotape. And that's the message. The message is that New York needs to pass a law now to require that all law enforcement officers record interrogations. Because when they do that, police officers will not be able to exaggerate or lie or misremember exactly how these confessions were created. All we have to do is press a button on a machine and everyone can see what actually happened.
We're talking with law professor Stephen Drizin, who's with the Center on Wrongful Convictions at the Northwestern University Law School, about these two New York State High Court rulings yesterday that threw out the convictions of two people convicted of homicide because police lied too much to them during their interrogations. Now, however, Professor, the court affirmed that police may lie during interrogations, just that these particular lies were beyond the pale. So is it clear to you where the pale is? And then I'll ask you where you think it should be. But what kinds of interrogation lies are accepted as legitimate after these rulings?
I think it's going to still have to be decided on a case-by-case basis. I think the strongest message you can take from this is that this court is going to look with great disdain at lies that essentially cut so deep, lies like we're going to arrest your wife, or we are going to we need you to testify in order to save the life or liberty or well-being of a loved one, that those kinds of lies may result in many, many more suppressions in the future. But there's a great middle ground and gray area that is still going to have to be decided on a case-by-case basis. The accident scenario, for example. In almost every case I've seen, it's not just mentioned once or twice by police officers during the interrogation. It's mentioned dozens of times. I think it was mentioned 67 times or something in this case. So if police officers use that theme but keep coming back at it, what the court is saying is what you're doing here is you're giving the suspect a promise of leniency, and we're not going to accept his confession.
And what do you think? I mean, I take it your own sensibilities are kind of liberal in general, if liberal is the right word. Your institute studies wrongful convictions, so that's your main concern. Do you accept any police lying as being in the public interest, as being in the interest of justice?
My current position on this, and I have to say it's evolving, is that I am concerned about police lying, especially police lying about scientific evidence, medical diagnoses, even so-called scientific evidence like polygraph results, because these kinds of lies have been linked to numerous false confessions. I'm also concerned about the use of the accident technique, because it tells a suspect that you didn't even commit a crime. But what I'm more concerned about is the police feeding of facts to a suspect and pressuring the suspect to adopt their own preconceived theory of how a crime was committed, because that preconceived theory is often wrong, and the ultimate and final confession is really not the suspect's at all. It's the police officer's confession.
In an article that you wrote about these cases on Huffington Post, you put them in the context of other police deception or faulty confession cases in the news in New York right now. You mentioned the Martin Tankleff parent murder case, but also the Central Park Five. How does that case relate to this?
Well, there was a lie in the Central Park Five case. There were many lies. One lie involved telling a suspect that his fingerprints were on the jogger's clothing. In and of itself, that lie may not be enough to have led a court to toss out the confession. But in that particular case, it was another case of what we call police contamination. These suspects did not know where the crime occurred, and police officers and prosecutors fed them details of the crime to take them from the area where they were congregating by the reservoir, you know, nearly a mile north at the Harlem Street transverse, or the Harlem, in that part of the park. So that final confession.
102nd Street transverse, right.
Yeah, exactly. That confession was a highly contaminated confession. They even took the suspects to the crime scene and showed them crime scene photos. So that confession is a great example.
You can't take someone to a crime scene or showing them photos. That's not lying to them, right? That's not the same as saying your fingerprints were on the body if the fingerprints weren't on the body.
In some ways, it's worse, because what you're doing is you're giving an innocent suspect information about the crime that he otherwise would not know, and you are feeding that to him so when he is at a place where he's hopeless, he can cobble together that information to come up with a confession that seems credible, but in reality is false.
Now, there's one other very relevant news item in New York this week. State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman has introduced a bill in the legislature to make it easier for wrongfully convicted people to sue. And it looks to me what's new here is that people who pleaded guilty could sue for wrongful conviction damages under this bill. Currently, you can only sue if you had contested the charge. Now you could sue if you pleaded guilty and then it turned out to be a wrongful conviction. And, of course, I imagine you support this proposal. It suggests that innocent people sometimes plead guilty to crimes they, in fact, did not commit. Why would people do that?
It's just sort of the great, dirty, little secret of the criminal justice system. And this, I really have to say I support this overwhelmingly, because there have been a significant percentage of the DNA exonerees who pled guilty. Now, why does that happen? It happens because there's an imbalance of power in the criminal justice system. As the sentencing statutes and the lengths of sentences have increased so much, it becomes actually in a suspect's interest to confess to something he didn't do in order to mitigate what his lawyers are telling him will surely be a life sentence or a 40-year sentence or a 25-year sentence.
And I imagine the plea bargain is a very coercive tool in this respect, because if somebody thinks that they can get less of a sentence for something they didn't do, then, as opposed to fighting it and probably losing, then that's where these cases probably come up most, right?
Exactly. And it's a very scary thought to think that as our sentencing regimes have gotten tougher and tougher, just how many innocent people have pled guilty to crimes they didn't commit simply because they were told or led to believe that you're going to lose at trial.
According to Attorney General Schneiderman, of the 27 people who have had their convictions overturned by DNA evidence in New York State since 1991, out of those 27 people, 10 of them had falsely confessed or wrongly pleaded guilty. So there's enough of a meaningful percentage to be quite eye-opening.
Can I say one more thing, Brian?
Yes, and we just have like 30 seconds left, but I saw that you wrote us that this week these various things we've been talking about in this conversation constitute an earthquake for wrongful conviction law in New York. Is that what you wanted to get at?
I wanted to say that the ground shifted yesterday, and it shifted not only because of these decisions and because of Mr. Schneiderman's bill, but because the city has settled the false confession, wrongful conviction lawsuit of John Ranta without him ever having to file a lawsuit. This was a case where a man spent 23 years in prison based on a false confession and false eyewitness testimony, and there was no DNA. So this should bear well or bode well, if you will, for the Central Park jogger defendants who have been waiting for more than a decade for justice in their cases.
Steve Drizin, legal director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at the Northwestern University School of Law. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.